Hello, you drunk. My name is Earl. I'm an alcoholic. You know, often people want a definition of an alcoholic that's simple. Very difficult to do that. But let me remind you, or let me tell you, a story that I witnessed at the 1955 AA conference, the second AA conference that was held. It was in your state. It was in St. Louis at the Kiel Auditorium. And it was a day, an evening, when Bill turned over AA to the drunks. General Service Board, the General Service Conference, and General Service Office had been started, and Bill was to fade in the background. This was a very emotional night. Not a dry eye in the house. On the stage was Lois, sitting in the audience next to me was Ebbie Thatcher, who brought the message to Bill. Bill's mother was there. Oh, it was a great, quite an event. But Ickey Sheridan from Texas was the chairman that night, and he told the following story, which I think gives an excellent definition of an alcoholic. He said in his Texas twang, which I won't attempt to imitate, he said, down in East Texas, we have a little community that had no facility in which to keep a drunk if one showed up. So until they could build one that was more appropriate, it was decided that he should be put in the ice house. Those are the days when, before refrigeration, when they had little green cabins and in it was ice that they sold. Sure enough, the drunk showed up and he was put in the ice house. That evening at dinner, the sheriff stood bolt upright and said, "Oh my God, Emmy, I've left old Joe down there in the ice house. I've got to go down and get him out." Put in his hat and he walked down the street and got the little green ice house and laboriously opened the big heavy handle and opened the weighted door, and a ray of light crept into the corner over here with a little drunk all huddled up who looked up at the sheriff and said, "For God's sake, close that door. I'm freezing to death." Now that's an alcoholic. With your permission tonight, I'd like to tell you something of my story. Not really materially different than yours, but something of it. But mainly I'd like to tell you things that I have discovered since I've been AA, which has been 30 or 38 years. Would you agree with that? Is that okay? Okay. let me speak medically, scientifically for a moment. I'm a physician. We feel that all addictions are the same. It makes a difference whether it's heroin or cocaine or alcohol or marijuana. From a medical scientific standpoint, they all represent the same upset in what we call the neurotransmitters of the brain. On the other hand, if you think I'm going to get in the middle of whether or not addicts and alcoholics should be mixed together in a group, you're crazy. What you do about it is your own business. But I can say that from a medical and scientific standpoint, all addictions are absolutely the same. A little unique difference. Well, that's beside the point. We feel these days, I'm not going to be scientific, but just for a second, we feel these days that addiction is predominantly, maybe not totally, but predominantly a genetically inherited susceptibility. We used to feel that alcoholism, even the big book says something like this, that alcoholism is a psychological disease. We used to talk about the alcoholic personality. We now know that's nothing. We know that that's not true. We know that the vast majority of alcoholics do not have any more emotional problems, when they're not drinking, that is, than do non-alcoholics. So that in general, maybe not totally, maybe not all of it, it's predominantly genetically inherited susceptibility. That's just the facts that we know them today. We know something about the things that are inherited, but we won't go into that tonight. In my own family, there was lots of alcoholism. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic. She was not quite as severe as my father. She was a periodic. She got drunk two or three times a year, But Betty, when she got drunk, hugged the wall as she was coming through. On her side, I had an uncle who died at the age of 47 from alcoholism. I had a cousin that died at the age of 30 from alcoholism. I have one cousin right now who has been in AA about, 14 or 15 years or so in that region. And then on my father's side, they're all over the place. So I come by my alcoholism very justifiably. If our diagnosis of alcoholism as being a family inherited susceptibility is accurate, and we think it is. And yet this does not mean that everybody in a family that's laden with alcoholics or drug addicts of any kind will become alcoholic or drug addicted. My brother, for example, who is 18 months younger than I, is not an alcoholic. You know, every year, my wife, Mickey, who is sitting down here, whom you heard this afternoon, and I and my brother and his wife will go out to dinner at Thanksgiving or Christmas. We go to a restaurant. Families are all gone, children. And my brother orders a martini. And he takes the martini, and he holds it up like this and looks at it through the light, you know, like this. Then he takes the martini and runs it under his nose to savor the bouquet. Then he looks at it again. Then he sips the drink and has the temerity to sit it down again. In my drinking days, in my early sobriety, it's not true now, this just drove me crazy. I would think to myself, why in God's name don't you knock that thing off? You know? You see, the joke's on me. He knows how to enjoy a single drink. This is totally foreign to me. I don't understand this. I have had a single drink in my life, but it was miserable. I don't understand the beauty of that, but my brother does. You see, the one thing we know about booze is how to drink booze badly. We're slobs, you see. But my brother knows how to do it. That makes us who we are, and that's why we separate from the goat from the sheep. I'm not sure which one's the goat and who's the sheep, but that's I'll be 80 in August, and I was alive during the prohibition years. My wife will be 60 in August. Of course, she's older than I am, you know. We're going to have a 60-80 birthday party on August 11th. My birthday is August 3rd. And as she said this afternoon, in our family, we don't live for the future. Hell, there may not be any future. So everything we do is for this one single day. You wake up each morning and think, here we are together again. So it's wonderful. Let me tell you about the first drink I ever had. In general, my alcoholism was different from some others. We're all fundamentally the same, but some different. For example, I never lost a thing, materially speaking. In my day, when I came into AA, which was 1953, there were great loss of fortune, money, jobs, family, and so forth. None of this happened to me. I was never in jail. How I avoided this, I don't know, because I never was arrested for drunken driving. How I avoided that, I don't know either, but I did. I made more money the last year of my drinking than I ever made before in my whole life. More than I made since, too. I love the taste of alcohol. If I spill it on my fingers, I like to lick my fingers and get the taste. The taste wasn't so important as was the burning sensation going down my esophagus, kind of and landing down there. I like that. I went with a friend of mine who is now a retired colonel from the Army, still a friend of mine, and not an alcoholic. And we went up to a little resort near San Francisco. That's where I lived at the time. about 50 miles away from San Francisco, and it's known as Russian River. And we got two tents. We didn't have cabins in those days, two platforms with tents over them, with a, not one tent, but two beds in there. And we went up there specifically to try alcohol. That was our purpose in going. We looked up a bootlegger whose name was Ma Martinelli. Remember her so well. Ma Martinelli was a great big fat Mamma Mia, and she had about 8 or 9 children. And later on, by the way, when the 18th Amendment was repealed in 1932, she started a winery and still sold Martinelli wine out there and Martinelli apple juice. That's old Ma Martinelli. But on these days, she was a bootlegger. We bought 4 quarts of red wine. A little paler than the wine we have today, and may not have been as strong as we have today, but that's what we got. We then went back to our cabin, and my friend Art sat on his bed, and I sat on mine. We both unplugged our cords, like that, and started to sample the liquid. Put the bottle on my lips and had several slugs, and I thought, God, this is wonderful stuff. Where has it been? How come I haven't tried this before? So my attention turned to the bottle, and I finished it without paying attention to Art or anybody else. When I finished my quart, I looked up, and here was Art sitting on the side of his bed with his eyes wide open, staring out into space. I thought he had died. And I was frightened to death, and I said to him, Art! With that, I jiggled the air enough so he plopped over on his bed. And I went over to see him. I was sure he was dead now. And I could see he was drunk. I'd seen this many times in my own home. So wearily, I covered him with a blanket. And then I thought to myself, what will I do? What shall I do? I was a little frightened. By this time, I was a little bit deaf. And what will I do? I was underage. I was only 15. And I remember I went out and walked. It was nighttime, of course. I walked between the tents. There were several rows of tents. I walked, looked up at the sky, and maybe it was kind of something of anticipation of the future. I noticed, I became aware of the beautiful, beautiful sky and the stars, and it kind of got to me. Well, I went back into the cabin, and I sat down on my bed, and I didn't know what to do. And suddenly I spied the other two bottles of wine. And I finished both of them. Now, that's 3 quarts of wine for a kid of 15. Now, maybe it wasn't as strong as we have today, but I don't know. That's enough to kill most people. But alcoholics frequently, not always, are born with a high built-in tolerance. The hollow leg of the alcoholic is quite accurate. True of the other drugs as well. Well, I pass out I awakened the next morning on the floor with vomit all over me and my clothes. I'm still dressed. And I just felt terrible. I felt guilty. I felt awful. And I never liked wine much after that. For the rest of my drinking career, that's the way I drank. Heavily when I drank. In high school, still prohibition. I didn't drink except when I could get it. But when I did drink, I drank large amounts. In the university, the same way. I worked hard in the university and was doing work at night to put myself through school. And when I drank large amounts. Medical school, the same way. Didn't interfere with my studies, but when I drank, large amounts. In 1939, a miraculous thing happened. All of us as doctors received little boxes. They were made of metal. And in them were all kinds of samples of drugs. Your box of Seconal, Nembutal, Tuinol, and Benzedrine. Now, I tried them all. After all, I wasn't going to prescribe these without trying them once, you know. I tried Benzedrine and went right up through the ceiling. And Benzedrine and booze and I became bosom pals for the rest of my drinking career, which lasted until 1953. I loved getting high. Many alcoholics say they get drunk when they're angry. I didn't. I went out fighting somebody then. Boy, they got drunk when they were depressed. I didn't. I just shrugged it off. Or they got drunk when somebody didn't like them. I didn't give a damn who liked me. It's all right. But I like to be high. I like to dream great dreams. And I'll tell you about the last day of my drinking in a moment, but let me just jump ahead for a second. My sobriety came to me in a similar way as did Bill. And Bill and I became very close friends. Not many people gained sobriety the way he did and the way I did. And let me describe it to you. I won't go into all the stuff I did and the shakes and the sweats. And I had a very fine partner. I never endangered a patient. When I was in trouble, I left out for several days, and my partner carried on. When I came back, then I was all right. I was never in my office drunk, never in the hospital drunk, but when I left the city, boy, I tried one off. Well, I decided that, let me tell you about my last day of drinking. That's what I'll do. I'll skip to that. My last day of drinking was in June of 1953. So my 38 days are not quite here, but the 38 years, but they will be in a few days. I went to a restaurant known as Sam's Restaurant. It was near where I live, near Mill Valley, in a little town known as Tiburon. And Sam and his wife were good two-fisted drinkers. And I went out there that morning. I loved to drink in the morning. Only when I was out on call. When I was on call, I didn't at all. I often went to the hospital and stayed there. For some reason or other, the hospital was like a warm, nurturing mother to me. I didn't have the craving to drink when I was there. I don't understand that to this day. Anyway, on this last day of my drinking, I ordered a Waring blender full of vodka fizz. You know the blenders, you know? And I ordered 3 double vodka martinis. Now, why I ordered this mess, I have no idea what I did. And I love sweet drinks as well as straight drinks. I know that I didn't eat when I drank, but now and again I'd eat candy, which I was kind of ashamed of for a while, till I read the book John Barleycorn by Jack London, and he ate candy when he drank, and I said, well, hell, it was good enough for Jack, it's good enough for me. Now, on this day, I was not blacked out, I was kind of browned out. I remember a few events. At about, I suspect, 1 or 2 in the afternoon, very sunny, it was June, daylight saving, I went up the hill to see my friend Harry. I'd gone to the university with him. Now, why I went to see Harry, I have no idea. We weren't particularly close friends. We were friends. We'd gone to the university. We're fraternity brothers and so on. He was a couple of years younger than I. But I was not seeking sobriety at all. I had been worried about my drinking for several years. If someone said to me, are you a drunk? I would recoil and say, yeah, I am. Yes, I am. Or do you drink too much? I'd say, yes, I do. And they'd say, well, why don't you stop? And I'd say, I don't know. I stop, but I can't seem to stay stopped. Remember one time on Sunday, I said to myself, I've been drinking far too much. I've got to stop this. So I went on the wagon for good. Never going to drink again. I went Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And Friday afternoon, I came home in the evening. I came home from the office, poured out a glass full of vodka, and drank it down. And as I did so, I said to myself, Earl, I thought you said you weren't going to drink again. I just couldn't stop. But I never called myself an alcoholic. In those days, alcoholics were considered to be on Skid Row, and I was not on Skid Row, that's for sure. So I didn't ever call myself an alcoholic. Back to the story about Harry. Went up to see Harry, and Harry said to me, you know, I've had lots of trouble from booze. I said, yes, I know that. I read the newspaper. He said, you know, my wife has left me. I said, yes, I know that. I read the newspaper. And he said, but you know, I haven't had a drink for 7 months. I said, you haven't? He said, no, have you ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, well, no, not really. I had read the article by Jack Alexander, who later, by the way, became a good friend of mine, in the Saturday Evening Post in 1941. And in it, it mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous and said that it was started by a stock and bond broker and was joined by an Akron physician, Bill and Bob. I identified with the physician because I was one myself, and that's all I knew about AA. Well, he said, you know, I've gone to AA, and he said, I haven't had a drink for 7 months, and I feel very, very good. That's fine. That's so. He gave me a piece of paper just to acquaint me with AA, which is something like this. It opened up. This thing opens up like this. And on the inside, there were maybe 10 or 15 statements here and the same number on this side, directed towards the alcoholic or the drinker who is planning on stopping drinking. I was not planning on stopping drinking at that particular day. I have been worried in the past, but not this day. I later said, when I knew what 12-step words meant, I later asked Harry if he was doing some 12-step work on me, and he said, no, I wasn't. I just was going to give it to him so he could read about it. Well, the scene changes, and suddenly I'm back on my deck in Mill Valley, where I live, a little community across the Golden Gate Bridge. And I was sitting on my deck, and I was trying to make out this paper out, and I was so drunk, I just couldn't read it. So I asked my then-wife to read it to me. I've had about 100 of them, by the way. And Mickey and I have had only 7 marriages between us. That's all. Well, we got a good one this time. It took us a long time to get it. We got it. And so she did. She read it to me. One thing she read was, don't stop drinking for anybody else except yourself. Consider that. Don't stop drinking for anybody else except yourself, or anything else, your children, your wife, your job, just stop for you. The next thing she read was, don't consider yourself a martyr because you stopped drinking. Don't stop drinking for anybody else except yourself, and don't consider yourself a martyr because you do so, implying, after all, you're the one in trouble. What the other statement said, I forgot now. And these two statements made a very deep impact on me. I have no idea to this day why. It was like somebody had taken a wet beer towel and just popped me in the mouth with it. It just shook me, and I broke down and cried. Well, you know, crying was kind of par for the course in those days. I didn't know it then, but certainly know it now. But emotional instability, while it's not the cause of alcoholism, it's the result of drinking. It's the reverse, we now know. I was kind of emotionally unstable. I would drive along in my car. In those days, Bing Crosby was very popular. And I'd hear Bing sing a number, and I'd start to cry. And I'd look up in the beautiful California sky, not as beautiful than it is here, but beautiful, and I'd cry. I'd look up, I'd see a cloud, and I'd cry. I'd look up and not see a cloud, and I'd cry. I look at my wife and my daughter, and I would cry. I'm sure they looked at me and cried, too. I don't know. Well, my wife patted me on the back and said, you'll be all right, and she disappeared in the house. And I sat there, and I never had felt so depressed. I never felt so down. Now, I'm kind of an up person. I have my down days, as is everybody. But I'm kind of an up person, and I just felt deeply, deeply depressed. I was at the as something had just broken inside of me. I don't know what it was. It had nothing to do with drinking that I knew about, but I just felt down. I sat there in this deep gloom for, it seemed to me like a long time. It had just been a few minutes, I don't know. By this time, it was the afternoon of this beautiful June day, and it was time to go up and build the barbecue fire. I had to go up about 15 steps to a very large area about the size of this platform here and to build a barbecue fire. And I remember sliding up those stairs. They didn't have a banister to hold on to, and I was afraid I'd fall. I was unstable because I was so drunk. I got to the top stair, and I looked at my glass, and I had about one finger left in the bottle. I thought, now, if I'm going to build that fire up there, that's not enough. That'll never do. I better turn around, go down the stairs, onto the deck, into the kitchen, make a tall drink, and bring it back up there with me. So I turned around to do just that. And as I did, an absolutely remarkable thing happened to me. I really don't have the words to describe it. I don't understand it. But let me describe the best I can. As I turned around, it was as though an explosion occurred inside of me. It just ripped me apart. Didn't really, but I felt like it. I felt pain in every cell of my body. Now, what that meant, I don't know. I have no idea to this day why it happened, but it did. Just was a tremendous amount of pain. And then I heard the words, "This is your last drink." I was kind of shocked by this. I looked at my little glass with this one finger, and I poured it out. I'd already had my last drink. And I felt just as relieved. I can't tell you how much I felt relieved. I had been seeing a psychiatrist because of some emotional problems, and I had never felt so relieved in my life as I did in this particular instance. And then a second remarkable thing happened to me. I suddenly became as clear as I am right this instant. Right this instant. Now, how you go from drunkenness, you can hardly slosh upstairs, to clarity, I have no idea, but I did. And then the words occurred to me for the first time, "You are an alcoholic. That's your trouble. That's why you went to see that psychiatrist. You call you drunk, but you are an alcoholic." Well, I couldn't believe this. As it occurred to me, I felt an enormous swelling and relief inside of my heart and chest. And believe it or not, the craving to take another drink disappeared from me at that instant and has not returned once in 38 years. Now, I have no idea why, but it just thrilled me. Well, I guess I went up and went to bed, then I'd forgotten, and I awakened the next afternoon, went up to see Harry, and I said, "Harry, I've got to go to that AA of yours. I'm in trouble." He said, "I thought you were pretty drunk yesterday." So I went to a meeting. In Marin County, we now have maybe 200 AA meetings. In those days, we only had three. And I went to this first meeting. Let me tell you about it. There was a table about the size of maybe a third of this table here. And at the far end sat a very wonderful guy named Clark Billingsley. He's now dead. I can use his last name. He was a community butcher. At this end of the table sat a little, only 5 feet tall, bald, irritable little guy who just hated God. He was a carpenter. As a matter of fact, tell you about Shorty. Shorty never caught into the idea of God. He hated God. He said, "There's nothing stronger in this world than I am." You wouldn't write. Except booze. And booze became his higher power. And the day he died, he passed 47 years of total sobriety with only a higher power that was inside the booze bottle. That's all. Nothing else. So when you worry about a higher power, pick out take Shorty. Well, he was at this end. Carpenter, the butcher over there. On this side of the table, a guy named Vern Weir, now dead, who was a community baker. And on this side, where John is sitting, with my friend Harry, who was kind of a half-baked inventor, and myself. Well, I want you to know that the doctor looked at these people and said, "What am I doing here with a butcher?" If anybody here is a butcher or carpenter, please don't be upset. Huh? But a butcher, I, with a carpenter, and a baker, and a half-baked mechanic, what am I doing here? So in my egocentricity, I grew about 2 feet. And I said to Clark, "May I be excused?" And Clark was a master clinician. He said, "By all means, doctor." I walked outside the Wesley Hall, and I stood under the linden tree, and I took counsel with myself. And I said, "Do you mean to tell me?" And I went down all of my honors, my professorial status at the medical center, everything. "You mean to tell me that you, with all of this, have got to go back in there to get a butcher and a carpenter and a baker and a mechanic to make a man out of you?" And then I paused and listened. Soon the words came to me, "You bet your life you do. Get in there." I went in there, and let me tell you that never has a doctor been so grateful to a butcher, a carpenter, a baker, and a mechanic as this one. These guys were absolutely masters at knowing how to handle me. They would just knew when to talk to me, when not to talk to me, how gentle to be, how firm to be, and they were just wonderful, and they got me into their spell. I turned on AA like a Christmas tree. I still am, you know. But I got that Christmas tree, I just became overwhelmed by what AA had to say. It was a new finding to me. It was just a beautiful thing, and these guys knew just exactly what to say to me. Well, I was invited to join a second group, which I thought was an AA group because, as far as I knew, only AA people attended. They had a tricky name known as, it was taken after a man's name, Sharman, who wrote a book entitled Jesus as Teacher, not the so-called divinity, but his teachings. And this group was founded on Jesus' teachings. And I was invited to go, so I went. Well, this was kind of a one-upsmanship group where, you know, someone would come in with very arch eyebrows and say, have you read what's on page 92 of such and such a book? We said, my God, we haven't read that, no. We go home, we got the idea this guy was one-upping us. So we come back and say, no, have you read what's on page 203 of such and such a book? And back and forth we went, and you know, it was just a real competition back and forth. And I went there for 3 or 4 months, and I floated up into the sky, way up here into a cloud that's kind of higher than God, and I felt just awful. Never felt so miserable in my life. Well, by this time, I'd learned to worship Clark and Shorty and Vern. I went to Clark, and I said, Clark, there's something wrong with me. I might just as well be drunk as feel like I do right now. About 4 months sober. I thought I saw a faint smile go across his face. He said, Earl, let me get you a cup of coffee. In those days, we served donuts at all the meetings. That's not true so much today, I guess. And he got me a cup of coffee, and I was like a child. I watched everything Clark did. I followed him across the room. He went over and sat down a chair, and he pulled up a chair for me. And I put my eyes were on him, just waiting for what he was going to say. I just had become entranced by what these guys said. He said, Earl, I don't know what to tell you to do, but he said, have you read the big book? And I said, yes, I've read it 3 times. He said, you don't learn very well, do you? And I said, well, maybe I haven't. He said, have you read page 79? Now, in those days, some of the old-timers will recall this, at least in California, it's true. We didn't call it the fifth chapter or how it works. We called it page 79. It's now page 58, I think it is now. So, have you read page 79? I said, well, yes. He said, I think I'd go home and I'd get it out and read it again. And I said, Crock, I'm going to do that. Thanks very much. And I put on my hat. I didn't have a hat, but I got one. I went home, opened up the big book, and I read. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Thoroughly followed our path. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Rigorous honesty. Completely give yourself. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And that rung a bell. Our stories reveal what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you have decided that you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, but the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember, we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, power. And without help, it's too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures avail us nothing. It didn't say half measures avail us half. Or half measures avail us 90%. It said clearly and succinctly, half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Complete abandon. Giving yourself thoroughly. Go to any length. Rang through my thick skull for, I guess, the first time. And I suppose, in a deep sense, it was on that fateful evening when I was 4 months sober that I really started to get a crack into AA and what it was about. And that's been widening ever since. Well, I didn't continue on with the other group. I stayed with the AA group and did lots of stuff. Let me tell you a little bit what I have learned, if you'll forgive me, about in my 38 years of sobriety. First of all, I've written a book about my first 35 years of sobriety. Some of you have it around here. My first 35 years of sobriety. And in there I have said, I got this from a friend of mine known as George Hood, who was one of the first 100 men in AA, that there are four I's, capital letter I, in AA. One is infatuation, where we just get turned on by what AA says. Now, not everybody is turned on by AA at first, but eventually, if we hang around, we do get turned on and infatuated. My God, I made more phone calls and went to more meetings and talked to more people at lunch, and, well, we didn't have many meetings, but I went to as many as I could, and I was on fire about AA all the time. Still am. Not quite that as excited about it, but I'm, you know, I don't jazz around like I did then, making many phone calls I did then. Infatuation. Then about 2, 3, 4, 5 years comes a period of irritability. Where we say, what kind of a cockeyed chairman are you? Who are all these goofballs at this meeting? What's the matter with these kooks? Who are these people that say we can't have drug users in our group? Who are these I know the way boys? Who are these fools? Now, I'm not quoting now. And so we become irritated and become irritable and we are dissatisfied and AA is not going the way it should. Something's wrong with AA. There should be something. AA is not like it used to be. It should be changed. And this goes on for a matter of months or years. And finally we get to an inventive stage. And here we decide to do something about it. I'll show these numbskulls. They don't know what AA is about. They just think they know. I know what AA is about. I'll start a new group. Well, I started more new groups than you can shake a stick at. I started one group at the Children's Hospital in San Francisco on the 17th of August, 1965, and it's still going, by the way, dedicated to the fact that the newcomer was a slob. Just old-timers should be at this meeting. Well, I was only sober about 12 years in. I wasn't even an old-timer. You know, how mixed up can you get? Well, if you think you've come into AA not to get mixed up, you better leave the door. If you've come into AA to get happy all the time, you're crazy. If you've come into AA not to have any trouble, you aren't thinking very clearly, because maybe you're going to have some. I know that people say, well, if you're unhappy, you're off the AA program. Oh, nonsense. You know, I knew Bill very well, and Bill was one of the most unhappy guys I've ever known. He was also one of the happiest guys I've ever known, you know. Then finally comes the fourth eye. And the fourth eye is one of insight. And that's when slowly it seeps through our irritable, inventive, and sometimes infatuation minds. We're all kids together. We're together, baby. That's the point. For example, right this second, listen to the silence in this room. You see, baby, you see, loved one, we're together. That's what it's about. It slowly happens. Then we go back and forth from infatuation to irritability to inventiveness to insight. They fall back and forth with one another. Now, maybe it doesn't happen just like this in your life, but it didn't mind. Let me tell you about some of the events that occurred in my life along these lines. I was, I guess, sober about, maybe it was 1 year, maybe it was 2 years. I operated every morning, and I got up early to operate. Maybe it was up at 5 o'clock, 4:30, because I had to be at the operating table at 7. And one morning, I was up at the same barbecue pit where I got sober, by the way. I was standing there, and suddenly I started to cry very softly. I didn't know why. And so, you know, weeping, I easily weep, particularly these days when I'm such an old coot, you know. But on the other hand, I was weeping. I didn't know why. I went over and sat down. Now, whenever I'm in trouble, I don't try to get rid of it. If I'm jealous, I don't try to get rid of it. If I'm envious, I don't try to get rid of it. If I'm angry, I don't try to get rid of it. If I'm resentful, I don't try to get rid of it. If I'm happy, I'm glad. If I'm joyful, I'm glad. What I do is to hang with each emotional symptom I have, not to wallow in it, that's nothing, but to understand it. I am obsessed with understanding myself. All the great religions, all the great writers, all the great spiritual leaders have said one thing: know thyself. They have said, know the truth, and it shall set you free. It doesn't say know the truth and you'll set yourself free. Know the truth, you'll set you free. Well, there I was up there, barbecued, crying, and I suddenly realized that I had never had a home. I'd never had a home. No matter where I was, I felt, well, this is okay, but I should be someplace else. I should be someplace else. And I got to that someplace else, finally, and I finally said, this doesn't do it either. I should be someplace else. That's where I was going to else's all over the place, like this, you know. Then I realized that it was absurd. The only home I could ever have was inside of me. The only home I could ever have was inside of me. It was very clear to me then that I had really been home all of my life. I've never been lonely since that day. As I stand here before you, I'm at home. I stand here before you, I'm not lonely. I stand here before you, I am at my own home. And I carry this with me no matter where I am. I've been around the world 7 times. I'll tell you a little bit about that in a few minutes. Always at home. Then when I was about, 4 or 5 years sober, I had become entranced. Dale and I were talking about this with a very fabulous guy named Chuck C. from California. Many of you know him. Beautiful guy. Fabulous speaker. One of the great men in AA, now dead. So happened he and I were born the same day. He was 9 years older, but the same day. And we became very friendly. I worshipped this guy. Everything he said, I tried to copy him. I was always trying to copy people and talk like they did. Or I was trying to read things and to inculcate what I read into my own heart and soul. I was always trying to copy someone else outside. Well, I just felt miserable. I remember one time I decided I was going to be happy all the time. Mistake that is. And I decided I would employ the power of positive thinking. Now, I'm not against Norman Vincent Peale, believe me, nor am I against the power of positive thinking. I mean, that's maybe you've had great success with this, but let me tell you the mishmash I made of it. I spent a whole year going around smiling all the time. Smiling. The more I did it, the worse I felt. Remember, I decided one day I was going to write a book entitled The Power of Negative Thinking. I never did that before. Well, I had become a follower. I was following others, whether through books, articles, listening to them, watching them. I tried to ape what people did. My own entity was zero. And it's not zero, but it was down. I was at a conference where Chuck and I were the speakers in Midlands, Odessa, Texas. And I yawned. I have to do it my own way. Now, if you want to follow somebody and that you want to be a second-class citizen, well, be my guest. I'm not against it. But if you want to be your own self, you've got to have the courage to tread the path in solitude. Now, I didn't say you're lonely, but we're all in solitude. In AA, we're in solitude, all of us, but we're together. In this room, all of you are in solitude, but we're together, baby. We're in together, loved ones, together. So from that time to this, I have done nothing but hone out my own way of AA. People say to me, you still go to meetings? I said, sure. They said, why do you do that? I said, well, I like drunks to begin with, you know. And you see, I have become AA, my brand of AA. Now, my brand of AA might not be your choosing of a brand of AA, but it's mine. I do my own way. It takes great courage to do that. I'm not patting myself on the back. I'm just saying it's true. Be your own guru. Listen to others, all of them. For instance, when you first 3, 4, 5, 6 years in AA, listen to everything the old-timers say, but don't feel obligated to believe them. They may have a kind of sobriety that you like. It may be they have a kind of sobriety that you will not like. It's up to you to choose. And this is one of the paths, one of the ways to do AA. There's a very great pamphlet. If you haven't read it, get a hold of it. It's entitled A Member's Eye View of AA, or it happens to say what I'm saying to you tonight. And I'm not saying this is the way to do it. This is just the way I happen to have done it, and perhaps you'll like to do it your own way. Then there are, I got approached, I'm on the faculty of the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco, I got approached by the Medical College of Georgia to accept a professorship there in my surgical specialty with one provision, and that is I would go to Saigon. Saigon, this is when the war was going on. I wasn't out there as a soldier at all. I was out there as a professor from the Medical College of Georgia, and went on leave from the University of California, and the State Department, through the AMA, paid the Medical College of Georgia, and the salary came to me, to go out there to teach the Vietnamese. There are other specialists sent out by other medical schools, but this is ours, to teach them how to do my surgical specialty. Well, I made many trips to New York and spent lots of time with Bill and Lois and the rest of them there. And as I prepared to go to Saigon, I went to New York and spent several days with Bill up in Bedford Hills, Stepping Stone. And on the way to the airport, Bill took me there, and he said, you know, Earl, I have been sober longer than anyone in our organization. Longer, much longer. And he said, you know, we talk about serenity, and I don't have very much serenity. I said, Bill, I don't have very much either. And I've been sober a long time, but this time, not as long as Bill, of course, but I've been sober very well. You know, I said, late 60s, and I got sober in the early part of 1950. But this made a great impression on me to find serenity. Well, got to the airport, and I shook Bill's hand, hugged him, he hugged me, and he wished me well, and I wished him well. And I went on my way. He'd given me a big book long ago, and 12 by 12, all signed by him, and I took them along with me, and I was a subscriber to the Grapevine, which I still am. And I had this sent to me through an APO number in San Francisco. So I was doing all my AA things when I got out to Asia and to Saigon. So it happens I've been to AA meetings on every continent except Australia. I've been to AA meetings, somebody asked me tonight. I think you were asking me tonight. Did I go to AA meetings where they didn't speak English? Sure I did. How do you know what they're saying? I can tell what they're saying. By the way they function, you know, the way they yelled and screamed. I got to yell and scream with them, you know. I went to AA meetings in Iran. Now, you go to AA meetings in Iran, you've done some. This is when the Shah. This is when the Shah, happily, not the Ayatollah Khomeini, not the Shah. And so I've been to AA meetings all over the world. They're all the same. Really fundamentally the same. I mean, in Nepal and Singapore and Hong Kong and Israel and all over the place I've been to AA meetings, and they're just wonderful. They're just like ours here in France, with some unique, oh, Finland, some long time in Finland and France and Italy and Germany and Spain, going to AA meetings, and they're wonderful. Well, I got out there and I got settled after, about 4 or 5 weeks. And then Bill's remark came back to me. I don't have much serenity, said Bill, our co-founder. And I didn't either. And I thought, well, I was going to AA meetings. We had one meeting in Saigon. I was going over sometime to Singapore to another meeting. Could fly over there. And I decided maybe I knew a little bit about the religions, the Christian religion. Not much, but a little bit. I'm not an especially religious man in a sense, but I knew something about it. And I thought, why am I out here? Why don't I investigate the Eastern religions? So I did. I investigated Hinduism and Buddhism, Taoism, Hindu worship, Zen Buddhism, a whole bunch. I became kind of knowledgeable about them. And I went on a trek looking to seeing if these religions might not give me some serenity. I wrote Bill about this. I said, Bill, I'm going to do an Eastern trip when I'm out here. I did this in rest and relaxation periods. I wasn't neglecting my work. I went to India, spent more time in India. I even dressed like an East Indian. You know, they had a dhoti. You know, a dhoti is a skirt you wear around like this and pull it up between your legs. It's Gandhi wore them, like a diaper, you know. And I was walking around with a diaper on, you know. I mean, I was going to give it the whole trip. I stayed in several ashrams, which are like our communes over here. I stayed there. I was the only white face there, but they let me stay. And one time I was in a place in eastern India, and it was an ashram run by Ramana Maharshi. And I was there, and it got to be Diwali. And Diwali is like our Easter. It occurs, as I recall, sometime in November. And at Diwali, it's a time of renewal. They change their clothes, wash their bodies like we wear Easter bonnets. This is time of renewal. That's what it's about. Well, they awakened us about 2 or 3 in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. It was very dark. Here we're in a big room about this size with large, big platforms with big pots of warm oil with fire underneath. And it was very colorful, you can imagine. The little guy up there was pouring out scoopfuls of warm water into buckets that we were given. We were to take these buckets and go into a little room, wash off all of our bodies. This is symbolic of washing off all the old year and putting on new dhotis. And we did. Then we were to walk around a mountain known as Arunachala. Arunachala means sun in Hindi. And we were walking around that. It's an 8-mile walk. All of them walked around in bare feet, but obviously I wore my shoes. And we walked around and we were supposed to say, Rama, they have all kinds of gods out there, as you know. Rama, Rama, Rama. And if we did this appropriately, sometime on an 8-mile walk, Rama, it was said, would come up out of the mountain and wave at you. Well, I thought this was kind of nonsense, but I did it. Rama, Rama, Rama. He got the whole treatment, so I did it. And I said Rama, Rama, Rama many, many times. About the 7th mile, I was so worn out. But I think I saw Rama come up 2 or 3 times. Well, the Eastern religions are wonderful. The Western religions are wonderful. I don't mean to make fun of any of them. But I got more and more and more in emotional strain as I was doing this. You know, on rest and relaxation periods, I'd go and I'd sit into Hindu temples. As close as I could get to the lotus position, I never quite made it, you know. And I'd sit there and I'd meditate and say, om, I did all this stuff. The thing that might give me something, I'm going to write. I told Bill I was doing all this. He thought he kind of liked the idea. You know, Well, at the end of about 3 years, I was totally wiped out, emotionally speaking. I returned home, I think this time it was from Indonesia, and I returned to my little place in Saigon, went to my apartment, opened the door and walked in and just kind of collapsed down on the floor. I was just emotionally beaten. And I suddenly said to myself, oh, the hell with serenity. I don't care if I ever get serenity. And you know what happened? There it was. So when I hear somebody say, I'm upset and I'm looking for serenity, I almost vomit. But on the other hand, I did it, I vomited, I tried, so if you got to do it, baby, do it. But I've not thought, I could see in an instant that seeking was the trouble. You see, here's the reason why, if I can be technical for just a moment. You see, in the material world, there is such a thing as time. For instance, it took us a certain amount of time to get here. We are here for a certain amount of time, and when this meeting is over, it'll take us a certain amount of time to go where we're going. That's very valid. We even there overdo it a lot. But from the emotional standpoint, and AA is about emotions almost solely, there is no such thing as time. It's always now. In the material world, there is time. The emotional world, there is no time. From an emotional standpoint, we're here. Seeking in the emotional sphere implies that if I do such and such, sometime, I don't know when, I'll get my result. It doesn't happen. The more you defy and resist what's going on inside of you each second, the worse you will feel. What you resist will persist. Now, if it's always now in the emotional sphere, it is, what time do you have to change your emotions? You're not allotted any time in which to change your emotions. So, you're left with only one thing, and that is to, with all your heart and soul, accept, if I can use that word, each emotion every second, the way it is. And if we do, we set into machinery, into motion, or machinery set into motion, you don't do it, set into motion, which brings about change. It has nothing to do with that. So all we've got to do is to accept our emotions, emotional states as they are, live our life fully, and have a ball, with no demand that it turn out one way or the other. Expectations, what kills us. I will do this so that mother will love me. You know, that mother may love you. And I'm not talking about a mother, I'm talking about a mother. All right? Because if you say, it's got to love me, and a person says to you suddenly, I love you. God, you just feel wonderful for about 30 seconds. And then all of a sudden it occurs to you, suppose he or she don't mean it. Suppose they don't mean it. And if they don't mean it, will it come back? And if it'll come back, when will it come back? We're back in the same old boat again. Same old stuff. So waiting for people to love you is nonsense. Now, we all like to have people like us. That's perfectly true. But to expect them to like us is a 100% total waste of time. And we are the greatest time wasters in the world, waiting for everyone to say, God, what a good person you are. For example, there's nothing wrong with anybody. Nothing wrong with any of you folks. Nothing wrong with me. Nothing wrong at all. You are simply who you are. I have a little feeling about the words defects of character. I don't really think it's my bias. I don't think we have defects of character. I think we're simply in the stages of learning about living. At this stage, we make certain mistakes and learn. At this stage, we learn certain mistakes, but we don't make these other ones. And so we learn. I don't think we're any defects of character. We're different stages of learning. If you get that in your heart, you're going to feel just great. Now, let me tell you about an event I had with one of my Vietnamese surgical residents out in Saigon. I had 50 residents, most of them were women because the men were at war, and there was one sweet, wonderful resident known as Tran T. Ming Cho. I loved her to death, never touched her, but I love her to death. I liked her to touch her, but I didn't. And one day I was in my office. I was the chief of the service, and I was in my office alone, just raising cane. Why aren't these charts done? Why aren't notes being made here? Why aren't the operations dictated? What's the matter? I was going on and on and on and on and on, on. And suddenly, in spite of my bulbous, boisterous thing, I suddenly felt a sense of presence of someone. And I turned around, and there in the doorway sat this exquisitely beautiful Vietnamese woman named Tran T. Ming Cho. And she looked at me as no woman had ever looked at me before. She was not flirting with me. She wasn't trying to get anything from me. She wasn't being sexual with me. She was just simply peering into my eyes. I had never had a woman look at me that way before. And her eyes locked. As I looked at Tran T. Ming Cho, it all of a sudden occurred to me. And I said, Cho, are you trying to tell me that it's all right? I thought I saw a faint smile go across her face, and she slowly nodded her head, implying, yes. Then her eyes locked again, just right smack, like our eyes are locked, like IR, our eyes are locked, just locked, looking deeply into one of those eyes. And suddenly I said, Cho, are you trying to tell me that it's all right? Everything is all right? I thought I saw a faint smile go across her face, and she then shook her head just slightly, saying, yes. So I say to you, if this very instant you're in emotional turmoil, it's all right, baby. That's where you are. Nothing wrong with it, nothing right with it. It's just where you are. From that little Vietnamese person, I learned the world. That's the third step in action. I learned it deeply from a little Vietnamese student surgeon. Just tremendous. Well, you know, we hear in AA a lot about surrender. Ever heard about surrender? All you have to do is surrender. You know, the third step means surrender. Well, there's no way to surrender. Now, don't leave now, but hang on for a minute. There's no way to surrender. What's the entity that's going to do the surrendering, and what does that entity surrender? Well, the entity that does the surrendering is the ego. And that's the trouble anyway. There's no way to surrender. So forget it. Now, how can you take the third step? You can't. But it can occur when you least expect it. Let me put out a little playlet here, and let's talk about this for a minute. This is so true of AA. Let's suppose I went to John with all my troubles. And suppose John, being an old-timer, listened to me, a youngster, with one idea in mind, only one idea, and that is to try to understand what I'm trying to tell him. You know, most of us listen to somebody talk, and we look them right in the eye, and we listen to them, we cross our hands, and we listen to them intently. We aren't listening at all. We're saying inside of ourselves, where in the hell did you ever get that crazy idea? Oh, what's the matter with you? Are you crazy? Are you nuts? But John's not doing that. He's listening with his heart and soul involved in attempting to understand what I'm trying to say. Well, this turns me on. I think, gee, I've been looking my whole life for somebody who will hear me, not advise me. John, I can get that anyplace. Not tell me what to do, not tell me what's right, not tell me what's wrong, just hear me. God, I get turned on like a Christmas tree. And I had to tell him more, because I finally found a guy who would just listen. Well, John says, wow, once again I've had the experience, like I'm having with Earl right now, that if I listen intently to what he's saying, only trying to understand what he's trying to tell me, it turns him on. He tells me more, and he gets turned on. And so he listens with more intensity. I tell him things with more intensity, and back and forth it goes. Now, when we start off, we may be at different emotional plateaus. John here and me down here. But as we talk more and more, we're drawn to a point where finally our emotional stratas are identical. We're looking one another in the eye at the same, all of our emotion, our devotion, our interest, our energy are at the same place. At this point, there's no ego. There's only listening and understanding. I didn't have to surrender. It happened. I didn't have to take a third step. It happened by just listening. Imagine if you and I spent the rest of our lives, we won't, but suppose it is, listening to what people are trying to say. We wouldn't have any wars. We'd have no racism. We'd have no sexism. We'd only have listening and understanding. AA teaches us listening and understanding. Now, when John and I are this way, and we have our energies, our attention, our devotion, our both the same, and that's all the same thing, by the way, like this, and we look at one of those eyes, and we're at the same point, we all of a sudden say, wow, you're like I am. He looks at me and says, why, you're like I am. At that point, we transcend and go up like this, and we feel glorious. That's at base the spiritual side of the AA program. AA knows this so well. Came to believe through listening that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Came to believe that if in an involuntary way we could let go, God would do his thing. That's what we learned. Now, there's so many other things that have happened to me, but now it's getting late. So, let's just talk for a second about what happened to us, all of us kids. See, we're really, in a sense, the chosen people. You see, we have been brought to our knees and have crawled to one another, looking one another in the eye, needing to lock in with somebody. Don't have to follow them, just lock in, lock in, lock in, lock in. That's what we have done. Booze, and if you will, drugs, brought us to this point. Our greatest friend is booze. Yeah, it kicked us right in the fanny. Yeah, it broke our hearts. Yeah, it broke our homes. Broke our relationships. Why? To bring us here on the 50th anniversary of AA in Kansas City and other places in the world. We are the chosen people. But as soon as you start to think we're chosen people, we're going to get drunk. So let those remarks kind of drop, but know that you have come home. A painful home, a turmoil home, a conflicting home, a joyful home, a happy home. You see, we're all alike emotionally speaking, not physically speaking. All bottoms are the same. Physically they aren't. Emotions are all the same. Because despair is despair is despair is despair. You reach despair, I reach despair, John reached despair, you reach despair, you reach despair. And it's all the same. My suffering is the same as yours. My pain is the same as yours. My joy is the same as yours. My happiness is the same as yours. But I'll be damned if we'll believe that. We think, no one has had the pain that I've had. Baby, you're screwing. We all had the same amount. We're all sitting here with the same cracks in our heart, the same joys in our soul as everybody else. Now, you may be at a joyful period of time, I'm at a depressed period. That may be true. And this is the thing. Now, isn't it strange? You know, we have gone to the great authorities, the doctors, to try to get help. And in some instances, they've helped us a lot. But the doctors cannot give you and me the kind of sobriety that we have got to have. The kind of sobriety that is present in this room in most of us. We've gone to the psychiatrists, and they put us on an endless series of couches and things to bring and talk to us and analyze us and done all kinds of nonsense. But even these great devoted men have not been able to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we must have, we've got to have. And we go to the clergy, the priests, the ministers, the rabbis, and they have devoted their lives to us. Yet, barring certain exceptions, they have not been able to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we have got to have. We must have it. And yet you take a bunch of damn idealistic, perfectionistic, irritable, tense, nervous, resentful, angry drunks and put them together. And you know, if you have a conversation, you have 10 people, AA, sit standing around like this, you got 10 different conversations all beginning with the word I. And yet, in spite of this, what seems like handicap, we stay sober. How come? Well, I suppose the doctors will say, well, what you coots have is a special brand of psychosomatic medicine. Almost makes me vomit to say it, but that's all right. Or the psychiatrist might say, what you have are benevolent interpersonal relations. Well, perhaps we do have. We're glad to hear that. And I suppose the men of the cloth, the priests, the rabbis, the ministers would say, what you have, you lovely people, is esprit de corps. But to me, the reason we have what we have is the very essence of God. God bless you all.